Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV, and I'm sitting with Robert J. Samuelson of The Washington Post and Newsweek and the author of the great new book, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Your book is subtitled The Past and Future of American Affluence. Let's talk a little bit about the past of American affluence, since it's easier to be optimistic about the past. What was the Great Inflation?
Well, the Great Inflation was an effort to improve American affluence. We came through the 1950s in pretty good shape. Most people at the beginning of the 50s thought there would be another Great Depression. There wasn't. Unemployment in the 1950s averaged 4.5%. People moved to the suburbs. There was an explosion of material prosperity. But we had a number of recessions in the 50s. We had a recession in 53, 54, another one, a harsher one in 57, 58. And then at the very beginning of the next decade, recession in 60, 61.
And by a recession, just for the uninitiated, that's two consecutive quarters
of negative growth. That's the technical definition, but in fact, these recessions are determined by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and that's one of the standards they use. But it basically means that the economy produces less for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Unemployment usually goes up. People feel worried about the future. Right. That's really what a recession is. And there was a group of academic economists who felt we could do better. We didn't have to have recessions. They understood how to
tame the business cycle.
Right, basic Keynesianism. They could manage the business cycle to either eliminate or attenuate recessions. And they sold President Kennedy on this idea and subsequently President Johnson. And the idea was that you could use budget deficits and easier credit to stimulate the economy when it was slowing down. And they did that, and we had a boom in the 1960s, and essentially we laid the foundations for an inflationary economy. Mm-hmm. Inflation was non-existent at 1% in 1961. By 1979, it was 13%, and it seemed to be completely out of control.
Define inflation very quickly in the most
Well, inflation is not just the rise of one or two prices. Right. It's the rise of almost all prices. It's the rise of the price level. So when I say inflation was going up 13%, it meant average prices were rising 13% by the late 1970s.
And what were wages doing at the same time?
Well, wages were also going up very rapidly. I mean, you had a wage-price spiral in which wages were trying to catch price increases, and then price increases were driven by wage increases, and you had the dog chasing its own tail.
Right. And this is, I mean, it's a general increase in prices that is irrespective of any change in productivity or... I mean, it's more dollars chasing the same number
It's
of
basically
goods.
Too many dollars chasing too few goods, and... Mm-hmm. That process overwhelms any productivity increases, which would allow you to have more output with less input, basically.
Talk about in the 1970s, what kind of unemployment rates did we see?
Well, the promise of this was called a new economics.
Right.
And the idea was that economics had advanced in its understanding of the operation of the economy. We had better tools to manage it and all that sort of thing. So the promise of the new economics was that you could lower the average unemployment rate, you would have fewer recessions, and they would be milder. What actually happened is we had more recessions, and they became more severe. So we had...
Well, it sounds like it worked perfectly, then.
Well...
Sign me up.
Yes.
It's a good thing.
Nobody sued them for false advertising.
We'll get to this in a minute, but it's a good thing that we don't believe in new economics anymore, right?
We have new economics.
Okay, So who were the architects of the new economics? Because it was not Keynes himself.
I mean, no, Keynes died in 1946. Yeah, right. And so we don't really know whether Keynes would have been a Keynesian.
Right.
And there's some reason to think he might not have been, because he was very worried about inflation. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he did feel that the government had to act at certain times to prevent the Great Depression. Right.
And I mean, the basic reading of the Great Depression, which you agree with, if I'm not mistaken, is that... Among other things, the Federal Reserve, which is a relatively young institution at the time, tightened the money supply in the Depression when the stock market collapsed, and as a result actually made things worse.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they deliberately tightened the money supply. Mm-hmm. The way I would put it is they allowed 40% of American banks to fail. Mm-hmm. And in the process of that happening, the money supply declined dramatically. people lost their deposits. Mm-hmm. Businesses and consumers and farmers that depended on these banks for credit.
Yeah, it's just gone.
Lost the access to credit. And the remaining banks became extremely cautious.
Right.
So there was a general kind of credit contraction and a loss of the decline in the money supply that the Fed, in theory, could have prevented or at least mitigated. And they didn't do it.
By pushing more money into
the system. By pushing more money out, by
giving banks reserves.
Right, providing money to banks that were in trouble and that were otherwise solvent.
Right. Talk a little bit about why inflation is a bad thing.
Well, I would say that even if you assume, which is not true, that inflation had no adverse economic consequences, it was a bad thing socially and politically. It basically, people, when you have high inflation, people can't predict the future. Mm-hmm. They don't know whether today's 10% inflation is going to become 15% or 20% or 25%, and so they become very fearful and very anxious. And it basically undermines middle class values, the idea that if you work hard, you will succeed, because people didn't know that even if they worked hard, their salaries would keep up with prices. That it undermines the idea of thrift, because people didn't know that their savings would keep up, would be eroded.
The only people who make out are wheelbarrow makers, right? Because they're going to be carrying all the dollars to get the loaf of bread.
Right. Yeah. In Weimar, Germany, that's what happened. We didn't get to that sort of situation. But the people, the problem is you don't know who's going to make out.
Right.
You don't know who is going to be able to protect himself, which groups will be able to protect themselves best against inflation. And therefore, your social standing becomes kind of a lottery. Mm-hmm. It doesn't become the consequence of your hard work.
Even at something like 8% or 10% inflation, as opposed to, you know, what is considered hyperinflation, or where prices are going up 25, 30% a month, it's easy to see that. But then if it's 10% a year, that is enough. Like, at what point does
10% a year is pretty fast.
I remember this.
If you were used to 1% or 2%
and
levels of inflation that were essentially non-existent.
Right. What? So who are the people behind the new economics? Give us names. Name names.
Well, before I give you names, let me say it was pretty much a consensus among mainstream economists. Mm-hmm. These were the enlightened ideas of the time. Who were the names that popularized this? Well, I'd say the first name that comes to mind is Walter Heller. Mm-hmm. Walter Heller had been an economist at the University of Minnesota. He became the chairman of John Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors. And I would say he was probably the most influential chairman of the CEA in its history because he basically converted Kennedy to this way of thinking.
Right.
But Heller was simply the most public figure here. And my namesake, Paul Samuelson, was a leading, no relationship to me, by the way.
We would have to stop this right now.
Well, I don't know whether we would stop it, but we would have to go through a long disclaimer.
Right.
Paul Samuelson was one of the most eminent post-war economists. He was at MIT. A fellow faculty member at MIT, Robert Solow, was another proponent of this idea.
And this was all part of a larger movement to thinking experts could control virtually every large institution in American society.
I think there was a great optimism after World War II of social engineering.
Right.
And it wasn't just social scientists at universities.
Right.
Corporate managers felt that they really understood how to organize prosperity at the firm level. And there was a group of people who felt that we had conquered the knowledge problem in many areas of national life. And this was part of it.
Yeah. So in terms of Kennedy and Heller and whatnot, what role did the Kennedy tax cuts play in any of this?
Well, the Kennedy tax cuts were passed in 1964 after he had been assassinated, and in part because he was assassinated.
Yeah.
He had proposed them in, I think, 1963, and it was having a great deal of trouble getting this tax cut through Congress. The idea was the economy was not growing as fast as its potential. You could prod it, nudge it along by giving people a tax cut, by giving them more money to spend.
Particularly people at the top end, I mean, who had more money.
My recollection of the tax cut is that it was pretty well balanced. It wasn't skewed towards people at the top or the bottom.
It reduced the top marginal rate from 90% to 70%.
I think that's right. I'd have to go back and check.
But it was, in effect, it was more of a Keynesian tax cut in the idea that it was to put, it wasn't because it's your money and you own it, it was to put more money into the system.
It was basically, the idea was that if people had more purchasing power, they would spend more, and if they spent more, the economy would grow faster, and because unemployment was higher than it had to be, this would bring down the unemployment rate, and the economy would move along its path of maximum growth. And the feeling was that we knew enough to in effect, engineer maximum economic growth.
So then let's cut to, say, the mid-70s, which is really when inflation really started to heat up, right? Because in the early 70s, inflation was creeping up, but it was
it really heated up at the end of the 60s. By the end of the 60s, you're up to about 6%. Mm-hmm. Now, if you started off at 1%, that's a substantial increase.
Right.
And it was already becoming apparent that the promise of the new economics was it had been oversold. Mm-hmm. And Nixon hoped to go through a very mild and protracted slowdown that would gradually reduce inflation without anybody really feeling it. Mm-hmm. What actually happened was they got a recession in late 69 and 70. Inflation did not slow down as much as they expected. Mm-hmm. So they got worse results on both counts. Mm-hmm. They got more inflation than they wanted, and they got a recession, which was slower growth and higher unemployment than they wanted. And Nixon was very, very upset about this economic policy.
So what was his response?
His response was to slap on wage price controls.
Right.
And but in fairness to Nixon, there was an enormous amount of pressure from both Republicans, but more importantly from Democrats, to do something like this.
Right.
And Nixon had imposed wage price controls for a long time. He had been in the Office of Price Administration during World War II. Mm-hmm. He developed a visceral dislike for price controls, but by August of 71, there were a number, large number of pressures on Nixon to do something dramatic.
Talk briefly in the book, you mention the types of contracts that collective bargaining units were getting in the 60s and 70s. Give us some numbers, which are stunning in today's economy.
Basically, people felt that their wages ought to keep up with prices.
Right.
So by the time prices were going up 6 or 7%, you were getting wage increases of 8 or 9%. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the 70s, you were getting wage increases 10, 12, 13, 14%.
Right. And, I mean, for like 3, 4, 5-year contracts.
Well, contracts, they would basically give you an average wage increase of 13%. I think it's in 1979, the UAW, United Auto Workers, got a 3-year wage contract of an average of 13%.
So throughout the 70s, as the new economics fades away and as people understand they can't control this, you have increasing unemployment, you have increasing inflation, and you have
increasing recessions.
Increasing recessions.
Right.
So what happened? I mean, your book is The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. Who killed the Great Inflation, and how did they do that?
Well, what you have during the 1970s is the Federal Reserve, which is the ultimate enabler of this process, because they create money, and if the Federal Reserve does not create too much money, then you don't have inflation.
Right.
But they were doing this because, in effect, they were going along with the new economics.
Even though they are supposedly functionally independent of the political arena, they're clearly part of it. And it's an intellectual consensus
as well. There was an intellectual consensus for these policies. And the Fed is legally independent. But as a practical matter, it can't completely go against the political climate, the pre-existing political climate, without persuading people that what it's doing is the right thing to do.
Right.
So what happens in the 1970s is you get these periodic recessions that are triggered by an anxious Federal Reserve that is worried about rising inflation. Mm-hmm. But as unemployment goes up, there's a lot of pressure on the Fed to relax its policies, which the Fed does. So the recessions are never long enough to persuade people that inflation has been wrung out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1980s, this changes because of two men. And this story of the book is that if either of these guys had not been in power, the outcome would have been different. Mm-hmm. And the two men are Paul Volcker, who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and Ronald Reagan, who was a newly elected president.
Right. Volcker was appointed in 1979 by Jimmy Carter. Why did Carter pick him?
He got it by accident to some extent, and because Carter really had no choice. Carter was trying to revitalize his cabinet and prepare for a re-election campaign in 1980. So here in 1979, he fires a bunch of cabinet secretaries, including the Secretary of the Treasury, Michael Blumenthal. He needs to get a replacement for Blumenthal. He can't find an outsider who will take the job. Carter's popularity at this point was at a low ebb. So he taps G. William Miller, who was then chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who was an ex-CEO of Textron, which is was a conglomerate, with whom he has close working relationship. So Miller becomes Treasury Secretary. Now this leaves a vacancy at the Fed, which Carter needs to fill very quickly. Again, he tries to get outsiders to do it. He can't find anybody. Volcker, at this point, is president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, which is a major position in the Federal Reserve system. Volcker is known as being very independent, and although he's a Democrat, he has been tough-minded about inflation, has dissented from Miller's policies on a number of occasions. Carter has Volcker in to the White House in a meeting with Miller. Volcker basically says to Carter, I'm going to have much tougher policies than my predecessor, the guy who's sitting over here on the other chair or couch. And Volcker leaves that meeting believing that he has actually talked himself out of a job because he's explained to Carter that the policies may be unpleasant because he's going to try to reduce inflation in a more dramatic
and
way.
And he effectively, I mean, Volcker knows that if he does what he wants to do, which is tighten the money supply, that you're going to have longer recessions that bring down inflation and also bring up unemployment, at least in the near
And everybody knows this. It's not just Volcker who knows this.
Right.
And so Volcker comes into office. He begins doing these things. He raises interest rates. He changes the way the Fed regulates the money supply. And, in fact, that's what happens. By early 1980, Carter is sufficiently agitated by the turn of events in the economy that he institutes his own economic policy and basically requires the Fed to do something it doesn't want to do, and which is institute credit controls. This turns out to be a disaster. The economy actually goes into a recession worse than Volcker's policies were leading to. And Volcker then has to relent on his policies to ease credit to sort of offset this. So the real Volcker austerity does not begin until after Reagan's election because Carter is kind of fiddling around with the economy.
Right.
After Reagan is elected, Volcker really begins to tighten the screws, raising interest rates, tightening
and
credit.
How what's the peak that interest rates went to?
Well, the prime bank rate goes to over 20%, 20.5%.
And which is indirectly controlled or it's heavily affected by the Federal Reserve.
The Fed funds rate, I'd have to go back and look, but the Fed funds rate, I think, goes to a peak of 15 or 16%. This is the overnight rate that the Fed controls.
Which is currently at 1%.
Lower than 1%.
Okay. Yeah. So it just got lowered, I think, today. Again.
Well, I don't know whether, but the effective, they had trouble lowering.
Yeah.
So Volcker then really begins to put the economy through the ringer.
Right.
Unemployment begins to go up. Reagan supports Volcker. Mm-hmm. And so you have what I call this compacted conviction. They never have a close working relationship, but they both share one value, one conviction, and that is that high inflation is disastrous for the American economy. Mm-hmm. Volcker does the technical stuff to basically crush inflation, but he needs political support. Basically, the entire political community, Republicans and Democrats in Congress, are against what Volcker is doing, especially as unemployment begins to go up. Mm-hmm. But Reagan gives Volcker cover, and Volcker is able to proceed with his policy, and unlike what happens in the 1970s, he is able to proceed with it long enough to really reduce inflation and to begin to convince people that the Fed is not going to allow inflation to get out of hand in the future.
What is it, where did Reagan get the conviction that inflation was a bad thing or that he needed to provide cover for Volcker?
I think this is basically just an innate conviction that he just has. He just believes this. He's also been tutored by Milton Friedman and other economists who believe that the Federal Reserve is the engine of inflation. So Reagan does believe that the Fed is at the epicenter of this and that the Fed can cure what it has created. unlike Carter and Nixon and Johnson, he does not believe that you can cure inflation by imposing wage price controls or voluntary controls or whatever. And this is the big difference between Reagan and his predecessors. And although Volcker and Reagan don't have a close working relationship, Volcker watches and listens to Reagan and concludes that Reagan has a visceral dislike of inflation that separates him from his predecessors.
And this is not even so much a function of government spending, because Reagan spent a lot. I mean, he cut domestic spending, but he increased overall federal spending.
And he cut taxes.
Yeah. So, it really...
So the deficits go up.
But it bears, at least in terms of inflation from a kind of economic point of view, it really bears out the ideas of Milton Friedman that inflation everywhere and always is a monetary phenomenon.
Right. And I would modify that by saying high inflation. If you have 1 or 2% inflation, it's not clear whether that's driven by other things going on. But when you have begin to have 3, 4, 5, 6, 8% inflation, you have a monetary problem.
What? How long did it take things to get under control?
Well, you basically have 3 years of an economy that doesn't grow. And unemployment by the end of 1982 gets up to almost 11%, 10.8%. So this is the worst post-war recession since World War II. And if you had asked, I think, a cross-section of economists 3 or 4 years earlier, and indeed a cross-section of Americans 3 or 4 years earlier, is it possible that unemployment will get up to 11% in this society at this age? And I think you would have found 99% who would have said no. So in imposing this recession, the Fed crossed a threshold. It crossed a threshold of credibility and basically convinced people that the Fed was going to do whatever it took to get inflation down.
Talk a little bit about the connection between breaking the back of inflation and long-term affluence.
So what happened after inflation began to come down is first you had a stock market boom. In 1982, the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, averaged less than 1,000. It was exactly where it was in 1965. By the end of the 90s, it was over 10,000. And what happened here is interest rates came down because as inflation came down, lenders didn't need as much protection against the ravages of inflation. As interest rates came down, people shifted their money into the stock market from money market funds and treasuries, and stocks basically went up for that and other reasons. People felt wealthier. They were wealthier. They spent more. We had a consumption boom. The same thing happened in the housing market. At the beginning of the 80s, when we had high inflation, mortgage rates for 30-year mortgages were 15%. By the end of the 80s, they were down to about 9 or 10%. By the end of the 90s, they were down to 7%. As interest rates went down, home prices went up because people could afford more. Then people began to borrow against their homes. And for a long while, this fostered a very solid, consistent prosperity. We had two small recessions, one in 1990-91 and another one in 2001. But basically we overdid this. And the consistent prosperity, I would argue, is the root cause of the current financial and economic crisis because people lost their sense of risk. And as prices went up in the housing market and the securities market, people began to think, well, prices will always go up. And they began to do things that were careless and in some cases criminal.
It was again a sense that we had slipped free of history and of the business cycle.
Once we had stabilized the economy and basically got inflation down, we had embarked on a kind of long-term prosperity that would be interrupted only occasionally by recessions.
What is the role, though, in the 90s of Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve? Because a lot of people charge that he consistently had a loose money policy, that was one of the reasons why interest rates were lower and that there was more money in the economy.
You know, we're going to have to await research on this. I don't think in the 90s particularly that that's legitimate. I think that, inflation was very low, and if you regard the Fed's first responsibility or one of their first responsibilities as controlling inflation, there was really very little reason to sort of tighten the money supply or raise interest rates. Now, it's true, It's also true, however, that Greenspan raised interest rates on a number of occasions mm-hmm. to preempt higher inflation. Mm-hmm. He raised them at the end of the 80s, 94, 95, at the end of the 90s. So it's not true that Greenspan just let mm-hmm. interest rates stay low forever. He raised interest rates to preempt higher inflation and was successful in doing so. Mm-hmm. And I think, too much prosperity, unfortunately, mm-hmm. and prosperity that's too uninterrupted perversely creates the seeds of its own undoing.
So is this kind of like the return of Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, argued this, that capitalism sows the seeds of its own demise, not because, as Marx argued, that the distinction between rich and poor becomes intolerable and the poor finally realize they're getting screwed and revolt, but rather because people get too wealthy and too soft and they lose an understanding of how wealth is created?
That's partially true. They lose a sense of perspective mm-hmm. and they begin to do... I mean, I think we've had two instances of this. The first instance was in the 60s when economists, after a very successful 1950s, decided they could do better. Then, in the current circumstances, basically markets decided they could do better. Mm-hmm. People who were in financial markets, again, lost their sense of risk and began to do things that were very risky but which they thought were not terribly risky. And mm-hmm. ultimately, the risks emerged, mm-hmm. and we were now going through a very, very worrisome financial crisis.
You end the book talking about, and the book is excerpted in the January issue of Reason, and in the little author's note there, you mentioned you had almost ended the book just by saying, everything is footloose and fancy-free until it's blue skies until the end of the day. But then you added a cautionary note in the book.
Well, I ended the writing of this book was basically done at the end of 2007. Mm-hmm. I did do some revisions in early 2008. And by then it was becoming clear that the economy was weakening at a rapid pace. It was not clear to me, and I don't think it was clear to a lot of people, that it would collapse in the way it mm-hmm. actually has collapsed, and that the financial crisis, which was worrisome then, would really become as harsh as it now is and as extreme as it now is. So I do have cautionary notes in the books, and you can find, if you read it closely, warnings that what has actually happened might happen. I identify the financial system as really becoming, in the last 20 or 25 years, an epicenter of potential instability. Mm-hmm. I don't predict that it actually is going to collapse the way it actually has collapsed in the last 6 or 8 months. But I suggest that this is a possibility.
How much of the problems with the financial sector, how much of that has to do with government intervention or government subsidizing of certain ideas, whether it's home ownership or government-sponsored enterprises such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? How much of it is due to the hubris and the arrogance of players in the financial sector, or the idea that they would be bailed out, that they would become too big to fail?
Among those three choices, I would highlight the second. I think mm-hmm. there's an awful lot of hubris and overconfidence here. I do think that the government contributed, especially in the home ownership area, by blessing in a social sense anything that led to increased home ownership. So subprime mortgages, which have turned out to have been poorly underwritten, loans went to people who couldn't handle them, mm-hmm. they were given teaser rates at the beginning to entice them in, good underwriting standards were violated. I blame that heavily on the participants themselves, but they operated in a social and political climate in which what they were doing was considered good. They were helping people share and, mm-hmm. and enjoy the American dream. And so the scrutiny that should have limited this kind of activity was weaker than it otherwise would have been. It was weaker because there were incentives in the market for people to undertake these bad loans. People received fees for these things. So they didn't have incentive.
And mortgage originators could make the loans, get the fees, and then sell the loans.
Right. And nobody in the system had the incentive to say, whoa, these loans aren't good or they could go bad. But they were operating in a political climate that blessed this kind of activity.
How bad has the federal bailout been so far, or how is that is that extending the period of instability? Is it addressing it?
Well, I would say that it's addressing it. I mean, it's open-ended. We don't really know where it's going to lead. Nobody really wants to do this. It may lead to it certainly created a bad precedent. Mm-hmm. On the other hand.
Why is it a bad precedent?
Well, it's a bad precedent because there's no obvious rules as to who's to be bailed out, when mm-hmm. they're to be bailed out, and why they're to be bailed out.
Right.
We started rescuing the financial system, which needed some sort of a backstop. The lender of last resort has been a traditional role of government central banks like the Federal Reserve. When you get a financial panic, if you don't have anybody who's sort of backstopping the system, you really risk getting a vicious mm-hmm. downward cycle, as happened in the 1930s. And you can argue that the reason we had a Great Depression is that the Federal Reserve in the 30s did not play the role of mm-hmm. lender of last resort.
But now the Federal Reserve could, I mean, the bailout came from the Treasury Department. Obviously, the Federal Reserve is involved in this and has increased the monetary base by something like 40% over the past year. But
the Federal Reserve really started at the Federal Reserve because the Federal Reserve began extending credit to institutions that had mm-hmm. traditionally not received credit, and it also began extending credits to banks which had received it on terms that were outside historic norms.
Should the bailout have unfolded the way that it did?
You know, I think we'll know that 5 or 6 years from now.
Right. When we're all wearing pickle barrels.
Well, if we're all selling apples on the corner, we will know that it did not proceed correctly.
I'm going to be selling oranges.
Well, take advantage of whatever you think the market is demanding.
So
maybe pomegranates, you know.
In a column that you wrote recently for the Washington Post, you said that President-elect Barack Obama has a choice either to undertake a bold New Deal type of thing, or he could save the economy. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant in the sense that he's promised an agenda of, I would say, not radical reform, but major mm-hmm. reform to the economy. He wants to combat global warming by creating a kind of a cap-and-trade system, which mm-hmm. would basically affect huge parts of the economy by creating an artificial scarcity. It would basically say you cannot emit more than X pounds of carbon dioxide. And if you need to emit more, you have to go buy a right to do so from somebody who already possesses the right and is going to emit less. And this will create a market price for carbon, raise energy prices, and it will basically affect the entire economy. He also wants to redo the healthcare sector to provide something close to universal health insurance.
I also believe he wants to finally make a light beer that tastes great and is less filling.
Well, we're all looking forward to that.
Okay. And he wants a national playoff system for the NCAA football Division I. So.
Well, we can all agree that is needed, too.
That's right.
So I am arguing that the economy is in sufficiently bad shape right mm-hmm. now that he ought to postpone these larger reforms mm-hmm. until the economy stabilizes and begins growing, because although these other reforms can be linked rhetorically to the economy's mm-hmm. present problems, if he goes after these large reforms, in my view, he will actually undermine confidence because mm-hmm. these are going to be enormously controversial and contribute to the economic downturn, potentially.
Now, he has talked about reading a lot by FDR or about FDR in the first 100 days, which, of course, the signal achievement of Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days was the National Recovery Act, or the National Industrial Recovery Act. So you're saying something like that is a bad idea?
Well, what I'm saying is if you read the history of the 30s closely, most of the things that were enacted in the first 100 days did not contribute to a recovery from the Depression. Roosevelt's easing of monetary policy and going off the gold standards undoubtedly helped, and I think that was probably the critical factor. Mm-hmm. But he could have done that without doing a lot of what else he did. But I would say in Roosevelt's defense that at the time, people thought these things were going to help with the recovery. I don't think that it's as easy to argue today that many of Obama's proposed reforms are intimately connected to the economy's current distress.
So when he says, I'm going to create 7 million green jobs, and that'll help the economy, or I mean, this is just kind of
the numbers. The numbers change.
Yeah.
I would say deficit spending for the moment might create new jobs, mm-hmm. but they don't have to be green jobs. And
right.
if you're going to create green jobs by raising prices, energy prices, and mandating certain mm-hmm. kinds of technologies that are more pleasing to him but are more costly, or you're going to create jobs by spending more or raising taxes, you're basically diverting spending from something else. So the green jobs will come at the
right.
expense of some other kind of job.
Did you vote for Obama?
I don't vote.
You don't vote? Do you not vote?
I don't vote for journalistic reasons. I don't
okay.
vote because I think that when you vote, you make a psychological commitment
okay.
to a candidate. This is not a rule that I would
suggest. And you like the Tuesday off?
I'm sorry, I didn't get Tuesday off.
Okay.
I worked on Tuesday. My wife thinks this is just one of the many dumb things that I do.
Okay.
But
great.
She's...
Talk a little bit about your intellect. You've been with the Washington Post for how long now?
Well, it depends how you measure. When I got out of college in the late 60s, I mm-hmm. worked for the Post as a reporter for 4 years. I left the Post, started with the Post in 69, left in 73 after having a fight with my boss. Mm-hmm. Freelance for a while, then went to work for a magazine called the National Journal, where I began writing a column. A guy at the Post saw my column, said we'd like to have that. So the Post began using this column on a weekly basis in, I think, 1977. I've never gone back physically to the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an employee of the Washington
okay.
Post. In 1984, Newsweek, which is owned by the Washington mm-hmm. Post Company, invited me to do a column for them, and I insisted that if I was going to do a column for Newsweek, that the column also run in the Post.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing a column for Newsweek and the Post ever since. Mm-hmm. But I don't physically work at the Post building.
How do you describe yourself politically or ideologically?
I describe myself as sensible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I'm fairly middle of the road. I've been described as conservative by some.
Mm-hmm.
I've been described as liberal by others.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I think of myself as sensible. I have some libertarian mm-hmm. instincts, but I
that can be cured now. There are camps you can go to, and they'll beat those tendencies out of you.
I'm kind of antisocial, so I don't believe
mm-hmm.
in going to any place.
Okay, where did you go to college?
Harvard.
And did that affect your thinking at all?
I went to Harvard. I would say it affected my thinking in a sense that I studied under a guy named Ed Banfield, a political scientist
mm-hmm,
at Harvard
sure.
who's died a few years ago, who influenced me enormously. It basically argued that you need to understand how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And he also talked about the importance of a stable political order. He was an empiricist who had strong mm-hmm. values, and he was also a great teacher.
He wrote a book about cities that was completely out of step
at the time,
and turned out to be completely prescient about
right.
how you need a kind of stable framework in a city structure politically, economically.
Well,
culturally.
He also explained this. The book was called The Unheavenly City. It was mm-hmm. written in the early 1970s, and he basically explained why the war on poverty would not work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extremely unpopular and unfashionable at the time. But one of the things that Ed taught me was you need to follow the evidence to where it leads, mm-hmm. and you need to have the gumption to state your conclusions no matter how mm-hmm. unfashionable they might mm-hmm. be at the time. And I've tried to follow that. And so I would say that Ed was a major influence on me.
Would you define yourself then kind of as an empiricist, or that's what motivates you? Is that you try
well,
to understand?
What motivates me in journalism and what is attractive about journalism is a way of exploring things that you don't understand and
mm-hmm.
trying to explain them to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I try to do week to week.
Have you seen a big shift in your point of view over the past 20 years, 25 years?
You know, I wouldn't say I've seen a big shift in my point of view over the last 20 or 25 years. I hope I'm learning all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt that markets were fallible. I've never mm-hmm. believed in a completely free market ideology. I do believe that government is extremely important, but if you're going to use government, you need to use it effectively and not
mm-hmm.
promiscuously. You need to have a good idea as to what government can do, what it can't do, what it should do, and what it shouldn't do. These convictions have been strong for a mm-hmm. long time.
Are you bullish about the future?
Less so than I was 15 or 20 years ago. I wrote
a
book.
I thought you were going to say less so than you were 15 or 20 minutes ago.
No. I wrote a book in the mid-90s called The Good Life and Its Discontents.
Which Reason reviewed favorably.
Yeah, and,
so explain the thesis of that
book. Well, the thesis of that book is that everyone in the conventional wisdom in the 70s and the late 80s and even the early 90s is that America was a failure as a society, and that we weren't getting ahead, and that we had not lived up to our promise. And the argument of this book is that the promise of post-war society was so extravagant and so romantic and unrealistic that it was impossible to live up to, and that was the source of our disappointment. But if you disconnected yourself from the actual promise that people had made, and the government and authority figures and political leaders had made, and asked what had we done in the last 50 years, you have to conclude that we were enormously successful, that we were better off materially and morally than we had been 50 years earlier, that we had made huge strides in race relations, that we had a welfare state that had cushioned the worst cruelties of unregulated capitalism, and that we had made enormous gains materially, that Americans were materially much better off than they had been 50 years earlier.
That sounds crazy.
Well, and that's what most people thought at the time.
Why is that kind of discontent a luxury good?
Well, I concluded partly that it was, but partly that it was also the effect of, an intellectual elite that had overpromised, going back to what we said earlier, had basically given people false ideas of how much social and economic engineering we could do. And if you accounted for that and then looked at what we had actually accomplished, we had accomplished a great deal.
Right.
But we had not accomplished what people said we could do.
So it's like we only hit 350 when we wanted to hit 400.
I would say, using the batting average, we were hitting a good 310 when people said we could hit 400.
Right.
We couldn't hit 400.
So that's 15 years ago, The Good Life and Its Discontents, roughly. Now, or looking 15 years in the future...
Why am I less optimistic?
Yeah.
I'm less optimistic because we have some obvious problems that we have not addressed. We have the obvious problem of paying the retirement costs for baby boomers like me. I was born in late 1945, on the cusp of the baby boom. And we simply haven't addressed this. And if we don't address it, we're either going to have much higher taxes, we're going to have to gut other government programs, many of which are worthwhile, or we're going to run deficits that are unsustainable, and we will ultimately have to either gut the programs or raise taxes. This places an enormous burden.
Can't we just get rid of the baby boomers?
Well, I've been writing this column for years and years now, and I had a guy come in who was somewhat older than I was. I was probably in my mid-50s when this guy came into the office. He said, "Well, Mr. Samuelson, I have a solution. First, we're going to line up all the old people and shoot them. Then we're going to line you up and shoot you."
Well, we don't even have enough icebergs now for the old people. Right?
Well, I don't know. So anyway, this is the paradox of prosperity.
Yes.
We are living longer. We have more fruitful, productive lives, and yet we're not able to face up to the social and economic consequences of longer lifespans.
Is there any reason to believe that politicians will address the entitlement problem before it is, before the wagons are falling off the cliff?
I'd like to think that there is, but my conclusion after writing about this 20 years is that there isn't. And that basically they will let things go until they're forced to do something.
Right. Well, on that cheery note, I would like to thank Robert J. Samuelson, the author of the excellent The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, for talking to Reason TV. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Nick.